If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Dave Musgrove, editor of BBC History Magazine, and welcome to our new weekly podcast. You're listening to July 2011 Part 2. BBC History Magazine is, of course, Britain's best-selling history monthly, on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. Visit our website, historyextra.com, for more information, or follow us at twitter.com/BBC History Mag or facebook.com/BBC History Magazine. So this month, coming up, we have...
This was not some sort of elaborate German ruse or deception. It was a real and emerging threat.
That was Joe Maiolo on the Nazis' V-weapons.
And within the houses of the boys themselves, they tend to be adorned with photographs of sporting teams and trophies.
And that was Jane Hamlett on Victorian boarding schools. For the first interview, we're talking about the Second World War. By the summer of 1944, it seemed that Nazi Germany was heading for certain defeat, but Hitler still had one ace up his sleeve. That June, Britain faced the first wave of attacks by the new V weapons, a flying bomb and a ballistic rocket. Historian Joe Maiolo was an advisor on a recent BBC documentary about the V weapons, and he's been speaking to our deputy editor, Rob Attar, about the challenge they posed and how the British reacted to this new danger.
Could you please explain exactly what the V weapons were?
Yeah, there were a number of V weapons. The two that were actually used in war were the V1 and the V2. The V1 was essentially what we would call today a cruise missile. It was a pilotless robot plane with a one-ton warhead that could be launched at a very large target, like, well, for instance, the city of London. And the weapon was designed to be fired in the general direction of the target. It wasn't a very accurate weapon at all. And essentially the motor would cut out at the point at which it reached an area over the target, and it would plummet to the ground and ignite its one-ton warhead. Of the two weapons, the V2 was really the more technologically amazing. It was really the first... a true ballistic missile, a liquid-fueled rocket that flew at supersonic speed and, again, could deliver with some accuracy a one-ton warhead on a city-sized target.
So when did the Nazis first embark on this V-weapon program?
Well, actually, it was the V1 was really the Luftwaffe's answer to the Army's V2 rocket. Now, the artillery slash rocket enthusiasts in the German Army in the early 1930s became interested in rockets as, in a sense, a high-tech solution to their defense problems. Under the Treaty of Versailles, they were limited to a very small army and could undertake only real, you know, experimental work. So they were investing in experiments. And the rocket enthusiasts in the army began throwing money at some young rocket scientists, namely Wernher von Braun, chiefly among them. And they began experimenting with rockets. They didn't really reach full-scale production until the war began. Now, one interesting counterfactual here is, what if they'd started earlier, and what if the weapon had been available for use earlier? Well, maybe that would have changed the course of the war. We don't know. But really, the Peenemünde test site, which was a joint Luftwaffe and Army test site, wasn't established until 1936. And real full-scale research with rocketry, large rockets, didn't begin until about 1939. The V1 flying bomb is really what the Luftwaffe's cheaper and actually in a lot of ways much more attractive long-range bombardment weapon. It was fairly low tech. Its autopilot was really, you know, a souped-up standard autopilot for any small aircraft. So it was fairly low tech and fairly cheap to build.
So when did the V1 and V2 weapons actually come on stream? When did they first start appearing in the skies?
Well, it wasn't until after the Normandy landings that the first V1 flying bomb attacks took place. I think it was the 13th of June, 1944. And essentially the landings in Normandy triggered the initial attacks with the V1 flying bomb. The V2 rocket attacks were not until much later, I think until actually the end of 1944, and they continued really into March 1945, at which stage Allied armies had reached their launching areas. So London was effectively out of range by that stage of the war. For the V1, the height of the bombardment period is really from June 1944 until early 1945, and the V2 rocket, it's the end of 44 until March 1945.
And what were the Nazis hoping to achieve with these weapons? Did they think they could change the course of the war?
That is the point. I mean, they were labeled as retaliation weapons by the propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels. But that's not what they were really meant for. They were meant to be a devastating answer to what was really a much more devastating attack, the a joint Anglo-American bombing campaign against Germany. The V1 and the V2 were the products of two armed services, the German Army and the German Air Force, trying to give Hitler an answer to the scale of the Allied bombing attacks. And both services believed that their V weapon, either the rocket or the flying bomb, if the attack could be launched with a great enough intensity on the city of London, you could force the British. One wonders what they imagined, that the British would somehow sue for peace, that it would force some sort of stalemate in the war, who knows. But what they believed was, if you could pummel London with enough either V1s or V2s, then you would force the British government by, you know, inflicting enough pain on the people to force the government to sue for peace. It has to be said, that theory, the idea that if you threw enough high explosive bombs at people, in other words, bomb cities, that somehow you could defeat nations at war, was prevalent in the 1920s and 30s. This is really the dawn of air war on this scale. So the Germans weren't alone in believing this sort of thing, but frankly, it was something of wishful thinking.
So realistically, what kind of threat did the V-weapons actually pose to Britain?
Frankly, very little. I think, to put it in, you know, to give it a number, the entire weight of the attack of all the V weapons combined on London was 0.23% of the high explosives dropped on Germany. So minuscule. Now, 9,000 people were killed. There was displacement of people. There were injuries. Houses and buildings were destroyed in London. But the attack, although frightful and damaging to morale in and of itself, the attack was never in any danger of changing the course of the war. And that was largely because the Germans couldn't produce and launch enough of them to have the sort of effect that they had intended. Now, you know, having said that, war is simply not a rational act. There was a great danger that had British intelligence not understood and identified the threat early enough, that if it come as a surprise, well, you know, we're asking a counterfactual question here. But let's say in the summer of 1944, the V1s and the V2s started landing and hitting London, Churchill, his cabinet, the armed forces had no idea that these things were coming. Well, one wonders what might have been done both in retaliation and what sort of military measures might have been taken in response to the attack. And that, again, might have changed the course of the war. You might imagine, for example, the Normandy landings being postponed until these attacks could be stopped. Or the reverse, that somehow the Normandy landings go from being about conquering France as a launching pad for an attack into the Third Reich, but instead it becomes an exercise in trying to destroy the launch sites for the V1, V2 weapons. I mean, these are all very wild, speculative counterfactuals, but I think they're worth considering in trying to contextualize what the V1s and the V2s meant.
So, yeah, you mentioned earlier that the British found out about the V weapons. How did they gain that intelligence?
Yeah, it was really through a number of sources. The most important being photographic intelligence, which identified and confirmed the existence of the weapons. But the intelligence came from a variety of sources. Some of it was simply through human intelligence, we call it today, secret agents passing rumors of secret weapons they heard about. And the very first mention of anything like a rocket comes in 1939. There are other rumors that appear, but the first real definitive evidence actually came from, you know, what would be described again today as prisoner of war intelligence. In March of 1943, British intelligence overheard and taped a conversation between two German generals who were captured. They were being kept in the United Kingdom, and they happened to begin a conversation that ran something like, "Well, gosh, you know, I guess the rocket weapons weren't as ready as we were and operational as we thought they were, because we don't hear the sounds of the explosions of them raining down on the British." And of course, you know, it was fairly reliable. They weren't being interrogated. They were talking amongst themselves and talking about how the Third Reich might win the war. So this obviously sent alarm bells ringing through Whitehall and through the intelligence services. Again, through prisoner of war intelligence, this time tricking a German general into talking about the rocket weapon, also confirmed that this was not some sort of elaborate German ruse or deception. It was a real an emerging threat. But it was a combination then of photographic intelligence identifying Peenemünde, which is, of course, this Nazi rocket test site in the Baltic. Photographic intelligence initially identified it as some sort of experimental station for aircraft. And in June of 1943, a photograph, which is, by the way, going to be reproduced in the magazine, identifies three rockets, one certainly being prepared for launch and two not very far away. And it's quite clear from that, in retrospect, it's quite clear looking at that photograph of what we're looking at are V2s being prepared for launch. At the time, there was a debate about what these large cylinder-like objects really were. They looked like large torpedoes or something. No one quite knew. And there was a debate in Whitehall about the reality of the threat. A committee was set up under Duncan Sands, Churchill's son-in-law, who was something of a rocket expert himself, actually, And he set up a committee where the scientific intelligence community and advisors of the government were brought together to debate the possibility of whether or not Britain would soon face a rocket attack. And to summarize quickly, a debate broke out between Lord Sherwell, who was Churchill's top scientific advisor, and R.V. Jones and others. R.V. Jones, by the way, is remembered as the father of scientific intelligence, and he worked for both MI6 and the Air Ministry at the time in the field of scientific intelligence. Now, Jones certainly believed that the rocket threat was a real one, and had been concerned about it since the start of the war. Sherwell was a very, you know, it's a very controversial figure, and later he would be sort of villainized as sort of the man who stood in the way of preparations for the V-weapon attacks gaining steam by his skepticism about the existence of the V-2 rocket. That's a bit unfair. His argument was, well, why would the Germans invest enormous amounts of money and scientific energy into, you know, a weapon that would be able to carry only a relatively small payload? Why wouldn't they just invest all those resources in building huge bomber fleets? And in a sense, he was right. Anyway, he argued vociferously in Whitehall against the existence of the V-2 rocket. He thought something much more like the V-1 flying bomb was the real secret weapon that the Germans were developing. It's a very technical debate, but essentially it boiled down to those who believed that the Germans might have made some sort of breakthrough in liquid fuel rockets versus Sherwell, who was saying, well, actually, no, I mean, the best they could have done is make some sort of solid fuel rocket. And to make a solid fuel rocket big enough to carry a payload to London would require a steel container, and that the steel to contain the combustion of the solid fuel would be so heavy that the rocket itself would not be able to fly. And I mean, that simplifies it, but that captures what the debate was about. But it was really the photographs coming from aerial and photographic intelligence in the summer of 1943 that confirmed Jones's suspicion that the Germans really had made some sort of technological breakthrough. Other forms of intelligence helped. For example, listening in to high-level German secret communications. This is known as ultra intelligence. Jones certainly made a lot of the fact that radar units of the German army were being posted to Peenemünde, and this was clearly in his mind an indication that these units were being posted there to track the test flights of rockets and other sorts of weapons. Anyway, by the summer of 1943, I think no one really doubted that Peenemünde was the site of something that was very threatening and had to be destroyed, and that just really begins the launch of the offensive part of Operation Crossbow, which is the Allied code name for their suppression of the V weapons. And in on the night of the 17th, 18th of August 1943, the RAF launches really what is one of the most remarkable first nighttime precision bombings of anywhere in Germany. And it was a very daring and costly raid, but it certainly set back the V-weapon program by at least several very crucial months.
The Allied counteroffensive, which was Operation Crossbow, how successful was that in neutralizing the V-weapons?
In war, timing is everything. Like I suggested earlier, if the V weapons had been available in 1939, well, gosh, you know, who knows? Maybe the Germans would have won the war. A lot of the German wonder weapons, whether we're talking about jet fighters, advanced submarines, or the V weapons, they all arrived just a little too late. This is basically the problem with them. The raid on Peenemünde, depending on who you believe, set back the V program by, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 months. Well, 3 to 6 months in that stage of the war was quite a long time. It sending back the program, of course, also gave the British and the Americans time to plan Crossbow, and also to use aerial intelligence to identify the launch sites. The V-1, the flying bomb, needed a fixed launch site. It needed a ramp, and it needed facilities for preparing the missile for launch. And once the footprint of these sites was identified, in other words, what it looked like from the air, it was possible to identify virtually all of them. And all of them, I think there were over 90 sites, and they were identified, and all of them were attacked, and virtually all of them destroyed. Which meant basically the Germans had to rebuild them all and learn how to camouflage them. And of course, here again, is the argument about time. The Germans had to invest resources and time into rebuilding all the launch sites, and this again delayed their program. With the V-2, the rocket, Crossbow itself was less successful in the sense that it was much more difficult to attack the actual launch sites, because all you needed to do to launch a V2 rocket was have a concrete launch pad. The rocket itself was mobile. It could be carried by a small unit of vehicles carrying the rocket and other ancillary equipment. And they could be mobile within a certain radius, and it was very difficult to attack any sort of site from the air. So the only thing you really could do was try and attack the production facilities. Of course, the Germans had moved the production facilities to a place in the Harz Mountains. In other words, they used massive underground tunnels to place their factory. So you couldn't attack the factory. You could interdict the transporting, the weapons being in transport, and the centers for fuel and that sort of thing, but they were very difficult to suppress. And indeed, with both weapons, the V-1 and the V-2, Crossbow from summer 1944 to March 1945 became something of a cat and mouse game, identifying the camouflage launch sites for the V-1 and trying to destroy them from the air faster than the Germans could rebuild them and in camouflage sites. The Germans became extremely adept, by the way, at hiding the launch sites and at, in a sense, occupying them very quickly, launching a few weapons and then moving away from them to some other site, so that while you might damage the launch pad, you certainly weren't going to destroy the launching unit. The fact of the matter is, as the war progressed, and that, from the summer 1944 to the summer of 1945, the Allied air campaign was being really directed at dismantling the German economy, especially the German fuel supply. And that was really the Allied strategic priority. So resources were being pulled from Crossbow to destroying the German economy. And there was a debate in the upper echelons of the various air forces about really whether Crossbow was a game worth pursuing. And really, by the later stages, the Germans were, in a sense, winning that cat and mouse game. But by that stage, the Allied armies were advancing had advanced through France and were moving into the Low Countries. And by that stage, well, the game was over, because the Allies had captured the launch sites.
So it wasn't, in the end, so much that Crossbow defeated the V weapons; it was the fact that Germany lost the war meant that the V weapon program ended.
Precisely. One way to look at the whole V weapon program is that it's part of that effort in the final years of the war to sustain Germany, the illusion in Germany, and particularly Hitler's illusion that the war could be won still. There's a debate about this, but I think really those who argue that, in a sense, Germany had lost the war by 1941, if not sooner, earlier, have won the debate. I think it's clear that certainly once the tide on the Eastern Front had turned in 1942, there was no way Germany could win the war. You had the Red Army expanding and the Russian war effort growing and victory after victory on the Eastern Front for the Red Army, and you have the expanding Allied strategic bombing campaign, the impending Allied landings in France. Italy's knocked out of the war. In other words, by the time Hitler orders mass production, full-scale production of all the V weapons in March 1943, really the war is lost. And as I mentioned earlier, the scale of production of both the V1 and the V2 never, and their capacity to be launched, never reached a level that even the Germans believed would be decisive. Whether or not they would have been decisive is debatable, and I don't think they would have been.
So even though Crossbone didn't necessarily halt the V weapons program, do you still think it was a valuable exercise in the fact that it may have saved quite a number of lives by cutting down the amount of V weapons that were launched?
Well, that's exactly it. That's exactly the way to look at it, I think, is that, again, war is not simply sort of these sort of pure maths and rational calculation. I think certainly the Allies had to be seen to be doing something to suppress the V weapons attacks. I think it was well over 9,000 people were killed, and many more than that seriously injured. So something had to be done, and those numbers might have been much higher had it not been for Crossbow. So certainly, and Crossbow, by the way, encompassed more than the bombing, the offensive end. There was also planning for defensive measures in London, you know, building more shelters, preparing for the evacuation of non-essential workers and from London. There was also, by the way, a deception plan to ensure that the Germans never improved their aim, and that was actually quite successful. The British used their turned double agents, particularly a very famous one called Garbo, who essentially used his notional network of German spies in London to feed back to the Germans that they were, the weapons were very effective, they were hitting vital targets, when in fact the mean point of impact of the V1s was south, was a little too far south. In other words, they were falling short. And British deception was used to convince the Germans that they were actually, the mean point of impact was correct. So that's another aspect of Crossbow that we ought to acknowledge. But apart from the defensive and the offensive measures, I think there's something important to be said about the intelligence, which is the fact of the matter is that, the weapons are identified in the summer of 1943. The initial attacks are made against Peenemünde and so on. But there was something about the fact that you can almost see the attack unfolding. If you're Churchill, you're his cabinet, you're the Allied High Command, you can see it unfolding, you understand what's coming, and you can take active measures against it. There's something reassuring about that. And I think Churchill basically tells the cabinet in early 1944 that, certainly Hitler is going to use this new weapon against us. It will be damaging and terrifying, but, I don't think we need to treat it, as a mortal threat. We ought not let ourselves become the slave of our fears. And I think that's an important thing to acknowledge, that, and it's something, it's a wider lesson about the value of intelligence in war, that it basically provides reassurance.
What do you think you'd say is the long-term legacy of the V weapons? Did they have any influence on later weaponry or other technology?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Von Braun, of course, is transformed from Hitler's technical rocketry expert and hero to a hero of the space age. Both the Soviets and the Allies, as the Third Reich is crumbling, make an effort to capture as much German missile and advanced jet technology as they can. The Allies are much more successful in capturing the scientists, but the Russians get a few of their own. And it's no surprise that the very first Red Army rockets and the very first U.S. Army rockets are basically versions of the V2 rocket. And In fact, I was having a conversation with a missile designer not too long ago, and we were talking about precisely this. And he said, "Yes, if we were to produce some sort of Darwinian evolutionary chart, the very first item on that chart would be the V2 rocket. The missile age is born at Peenemünde with von Braun's breakthroughs in liquid fuel rocket technology, and." The marriage of the rocket, one of the war's most important technical breakthroughs, with the nuclear weapon, of course, which is the American technological breakthrough, in a sense sets the foundations for the Cold War arms race that really gathers pace by the late 1950s and early 60s in the case of long range missiles and eventually intercontinental ballistic missiles and cruise missiles. Rockets, whether it's Scud missiles or rockets to shoot down missiles, they all owe something to the early technological breakthroughs at Peenemünde. So we live with this problem till today.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
That was Joe Maiolo of King's College London, and you can read his feature on the V weapons in our July issue. Now, the second interview this week is with Dr. Jane Hamlett, who's lecturer in modern British history at Royal Holloway University of London. Jane is leading a research project called A Home in the Institution, Asylum, School and Lodging House Interiors in London and South East England, 1845 to 1914. I popped into her office to find out more. And the first question I put to her was why her research starts in 1845.
We're looking sort of primarily from 1845, which was the point at which these particular institutions expanded. Public schools for boys expand from the beginning of the 19th century. Lunatic asylums are built on a mass scale from the Lunacy Acts of 1845. Mm-hmm. And lodging houses are increasingly regulated throughout the 19th century, particularly from 1851, because that was the point at which the Common Lodging Houses Act made it illegal for keepers to keep a lodging house without having it registered with the police. So,
okay, could you clarify what a lodging house actually means in this context?
Oh, okay, well, in 19th century London, lodging took place across the city, but for those with very little financial means, the common lodging house was often the place they turned to because it was the cheapest. However, these places were often very could described by middle-class observers as extremely unsanitary, as dark, cramped, badly kept, dirty, and middle-class observers were also very critical of the conditions in which people lived within them. Common lodging houses were actually in place across Britain in this period, but more and more pressure was put on them, particularly in London, as space was in sort of under a lot of pressure at this point. We're interested in them because they are a sphere of working class activity, a sphere of working class life, which gradually becomes increasingly regulated by the state. They're very, very sort of heavily criticised by middle class observers, and then the state and the police gradually move into them. So we see them as a kind of partially institutionalised space, if you like.
Okay, is it for the modern listener? Is there any anything that's akin to a lodging house today? Are they like a really nasty hostel?
If you could imagine a really unpleasant hostel with very poor sanitation, mixed sleeping conditions and very limited rules and regulations, then you might be you might come close to what life was like in a common lodging house.
Okay. So you're investigating these free forms of building through the medium of material culture.
Yes.
So what does that mean, material culture?
We're including space within that. So we're looking at how these places are planned and arranged, what's the room layout, and what's the impact of that on how people move through space, how their lives are organised. We're also thinking about the design and interior decoration of those buildings. So, you know, how is identity created by, for example, the use of portraits in public schools? And we're also thinking about material culture in the sense of how much power the inmates have to bring things into those spaces. So if you think about public lunatic asylums, for example, one of the first things that happened when patients were admitted to these asylums, if they were seen as paupers, would be that all their personal clothing was taken away, all their personal possessions were taken away. So we're looking at the things they were allowed to keep in asylums, the clothes they ended up wearing, and what the impact was on their idea of themselves, their individuality and their personal autonomy.
Mm. And is there any commonality between the three sorts of places in terms of how they were organised?
That's a really interesting question. And because we're halfway through the research, if you like, I'm not really in a very strong position to answer that question as yet. Although, interestingly, so far, some of the strongest similarities I've noticed are between the organisation of lunatic asylums and schools for girls, both of which seem to draw very heavily on Bentham's idea of a panopticon and surveillance, and are designed...
You'd better just...
Oh, okay.
Bentham's idea of panopticon and surveillance.
Yes. Well, basically, Jeremy Bentham, famously in the early 19th century, outlined a design for a prison called the panopticon. And the idea was that it was spatially arranged so it was possible for the prison warders to survey the prisoners from every possible angle, and to watch them as much as they could. Actually, this design wasn't built and it didn't work terribly well. But it was very influential on the design of other 19th century institutions, and particularly some of the private asylums we're looking at were built, for example, with secret viewing holes in the doors of patient rooms. So asylum attendants and servants would be able to sort of look at them and see what they were doing the whole time. And interestingly, I found that in some of the purpose-built girls' dormitories from the same period, these were actually also built with these viewing holes, so prefects or teachers could monitor what the girls were doing in the dormitory. All the time, which is quite interesting.
Sounds reasonably dodgy.
Yes.
Okay, so how are you investigating these places then? What resources are you drawing on? Are you carrying out physical surveys of these buildings if they're still standing? Is it maps, plans? What are you looking at?
We're basically using primarily archival sources because we're mainly looking at interiors and material decoration, and these things actually often don't survive, although sometimes objects from asylums or schools are preserved by the institutions themselves and we can look at them. We're mainly working from archival sources like plans. Photographs are of course brilliant for telling us what interiors looked like at the time, inventories, lists of contents, and of course you can imagine institutional records like sort of ledgers, account books, committee meetings where they discussed, you know, what should be put on the walls. I think probably the most useful source though is things like diaries, letters, autobiographies, sources that tell us what the inmates within these institutions actually thought of the spaces and how they reacted to them. And it's very easy to do that kind of research for schools, particularly middle class schools, because you can imagine that the pupils who are literate and tended to go on to write about their experiences. But it's much, much harder for, say, the public asylums. We've got very few accounts from pauper lunatics, and we've got to try and pursue their experiences in a very different way. In fact, we've been looking very closely at patient case books from these asylums, and these are of course really problematic because they were compiled by the staff observing what the patients were doing. So in a way it's very much not the patient's own voice that's being represented, but you know, nevertheless, this is in some cases the only record that survives of how these people were actually experiencing life in these places. And so what we've got to do is try and read between the lines, and work out perhaps from complaints or actions that is described how they might have been reacting to the material world around them.
Okay, so what can we say, learn from the type of wallpaper that was in a public school?
Well, that's quite interesting. In fact, there wasn't much wallpaper in boys' public schools, as you can imagine.
No.
And in fact, the authorities of boys' public schools were quite keen to create a deliberately institutional environment that was not necessarily like the home in this period. I mean, part of the purpose of sending boys to school was that they would be in an environment that was separate from the home. And in a way, it was expected that they would be, you know, they would become more manly by being in this environment. So, you know, wallpaper was very much not present in boys' public schools. Instead, you might expect walls to be plain. Mm-hmm. I think you would see a lot of portraits of benefactors or headmasters, that kind of thing. And within the houses of the boys themselves, in the later 19th century, increasingly, they tend to be adorned with photographs of sporting teams, and trophies are very prominently displayed. So these interiors are often very much about the institutional life of the school, and sporting achievement is very important.
So what does that teach us about what the Victorians were trying to do in public schools? Does it enlighten us on the underlying reason for a public school?
Yes, it does. I mean, in a way, it helps us understand what the environment of these public schools were like, and what we hope what was to be achieved, as it were, by sending your son away from home. You know, it was as early as age 7, which is what happened.
Yeah.
And the idea is that these boys would form bonds with other boys, and through this system, they would become suitable individuals. They would become sort of manly characters and would be suitable to take on a governmental role later, and of course to play a wider role in the empire. Actually, it's not so much the material things that set these things up as the way these schools were organised spatially.
Right.
Within the schools, boys, you may well know that boys, it's still the case today, boys lived in houses, sort of separately from the school, under a housemaster. And within these houses, what happened was the housemaster lived in a private side of the house, and actually often had very little to do with what the boys were doing in their everyday life. They were in fact organised amongst themselves under a prefect system usually. And so this worked spatially. There was a distance between the boys and the school authorities, those who were supposed to be governing them. And the idea was that by leaving the boys to themselves in this way, they would become self-governing. Small boys would look up to prefects. Prefects would get used to the exercise of authority, and that would make them, again, suitable to lead government and to take forward all the things that were expected of the middle and upper classes in this period. So we can see very clearly, I think, that the way in which these boys were left of themselves spatially, and this was reflected in the architecture, that this was designed to create a certain set of relationships between them. Of course, it didn't work very well, and actually in certain cases we see extreme cultures of violence amongst these boys who were left to themselves, some extreme forms of bullying, and sometimes a lot of sexual exploitation as well. So, you know, it didn't necessarily work, but that was the idea.
And you say it was designed. Was it actually deliberate, or was this sort of an organic development from how public schools have been prior to the Victorian period? Or did someone actually say, this is how we're going to design these schools, and this is the end point that we want to reach?
Combination of the two. I think you can see it in the design, because if you look at the plans for these houses, a private side is very clearly marked off and separated. However, I think as is always the case with architectural design, these plans were realised by individual house masters themselves, who, once they were running a house, would make a choice about how far they intervened in the life of the boys. And some of them were quite reticent. For example, one house master at Winchester would put on a top hat to show when he was actually going to come into the boys' side of the house to warn them when he was coming. Although some house masters were quite different and were actually a lot more involved in the boys' life. So actually we can see that this system worked in different ways and was very much dependent on the individual house master and how he wanted it to operate.
Okay, so just broadening out again, beyond the schools to all the places you're looking at, what are we going to learn about Victorian society by looking at by studying this? How is our knowledge going to be advanced?
Well, really, what we're going to find out is the nature of institutional life was. And the point of this research is really to try and work out how these institutions were experienced by the inmates, because Victorian institutions have long been a subject of interest to historians, and the reasons why suddenly all these institutions expand in this way in the 19th century have been sort of speculated on and argued over for quite a long time, and probably most famously by Foucault, who talked about a rise of institutions from the late 18th century. But really what I'm trying to find out is how people living in those institutions on an everyday basis experienced them. What were their lives actually like? And by looking at the material objects they were allowed to use, this is really a new way of getting at that experience. And that's really what we're trying to do.
So that was Jane Hamlett from Royal Holloway, University of London. Her most recent book is Material Relations, Families and Domestic Interiors in England, 1850 to 1910, and that's published by Manchester University Press. I hope you enjoyed those interviews. Don't forget that the English Heritage Festival of History is coming up at Kelmarsh Hall on the 16th and 17th of July. More information can be found at english-heritage.org.uk or in the current issue of BBC History Magazine, which includes a free day planner to the event. The magazine will have a stand there, so do pop by and say hello if you're visiting. Now, we'd really like to hear more from you about what you think about this podcast and the interviews, so you can contact us by emailing podcast@historyextra.com or calling a voicemail number where you can leave a message. That number is a UK line, 0117 230 2002. UK landline callers will pay local rates. Overseas charges and charges from other operators may vary. We've had some really positive responses to our new weekly podcast schedule, so I thought I'd read out a couple of the emails I've got. This one's from Robbie from Brooklyn, who says, "I'm incredibly fortunate that I can listen to my iPod at work, and every month I'd look forward with bated breath to the new BBC History Magazine podcast. Now I feel like my joy has quadrupled. Thank you so much for brightening up my days in the Cube Farm." No problems, Robbie. And Sheila from New Zealand, who is a lover of history and walking apparently, emailed to say that Auckland, where I live, is a very hilly place, and having an MP3 with something interesting to listen to makes short works of the ascending and descending. It's great to be stimulated and thinking about various topics. Delighted to help. All feedback is welcome about the podcast, the quality and the interviews that we're doing, so do please keep emailing or calling, and we will continue to read out anything that we get in. That's it for this week. Next time we have the start of a five-part series on the Tudor monarchs, kicking off with an analysis of the reign of Henry VII, plus a chat about the fine roles of Henry III. So I do hope you'll listen in.